This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about the government's prosecution of Tariq Mahana. The Massachusetts man was arrested 2 years ago and is now on trial in federal court in Boston.
He's charged with conspiracy to provide material support to terrorists. Critics say he's being prosecuted for merely expressing his views. So what do you think? Given what we know about groups like Al-Qaeda and what they're capable of, is the government justified in prosecuting cases like this?
You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. And joining us here in the studio is Harvey Silverglate. He's a Boston criminal defense and civil liberties litigator. He's also author of Three Felonies a Day, How the Feds Target the Innocent. And Harvey Silverglate, welcome back to Radio Boston. Great to have you.
It's good to be here.
Also with us by phone is Captain Glenn Sulmasy. He's a law professor at the U.S. Coast Guard Academy in Connecticut and author of The National Security Court System, A Natural Evolution of Justice in an Age of Terror. He joins us from Miami, where he's giving a lecture on terrorism prosecution. And Glenn Sulmasy, thanks for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And we're going to note from the outset, Glenn Sulmasy, you're joining us to give your own views on the case. You're not representing the views of the Coast Guard or the federal government.
Thank you very much.
We just wanted to get that out in the open. Let me start with you, Harvey. The government says this case is about terrorism. You see it more as about the First Amendment. Why?
Well, because this fellow didn't actually engage in any acts of terrorism. He translated documents and he spoke, sometimes rather strongly, but he spoke. And the real question is whether we are going to now change the law in this country and criminalize speech. Now, I'm not saying that's not going to happen. Things have not been going well for the First Amendment in the so-called terrorism area. But right now, as the law has stood for quite a long time, many decades, what Mahana has done should be protected by the First Amendment. This trial will determine whether that's still the case.
Well, let me ask you about that, because, of course, there are exceptions, and you know this better than me, to First Amendment rights. I mean, let me just throw out a sort of layman's understanding, the so-called clear and present danger exception. Mm-hmm. We know you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. Why aren't government lawyers or prosecutors correct to say you can't incite people to go and join Al-Qaeda, to blow up American soldiers and officials and so on?
Because the Supreme Court has defined incitement in a certain way, starting at least as far back as 1969, a very famous case called Brandenburg versus Ohio, in which the court said that in order to criminalize speech, the violent response to it has to be immediate, imminent. That's why the shouting fire in a crowded theater is such a good example, because nobody has time to think. Nobody has time to process. You yell fire and they stampede for the doors and people necessarily and inevitably get hurt. But that is not the same as political speech, even political speech that advocates violence. That is and has been protected in this country. And what the federal government is trying to get the courts to do, and I fear that the courts may start to go along with the government, because the government keeps crying, you know, that we're going to be hit with terrorist attacks if we don't do something about this violent speech. And that's what trials like Mahana are really about. They are proving grounds for the government to show that they have at last gotten to the point where speech is a criminal violation in this country.
Glenn Sulmasy, let me bring you into this conversation. Is that what this case is about? Is this just the government basically going after a case to make speech criminal?
No, I don't think so at all, though, due respect to Harvey. I think this words matter, as we know, and one of the items we've been seeing along is material support to terrorists is what he's being charged with, Mahana. And it's conspiracy to provide material support to terrorists. And it's perjury and a few other items that are in there that this has been being cast as being a First Amendment issue. But the reality is, anytime you're involved in some sort of an armed conflict, which I would suggest the war against Al-Qaeda is and has been, you have this sort of balancing test between the promotion of civil liberties, the rule of law, human rights, and the legitimate safety of the citizenry, the protection of the national security in the homeland. And you're seeing this play out before us in this case, and that's why I think it's fascinating. It's great that you're covering it, and the coverage has been wonderful to listen
well,
to.
Well, it is an it's a fascinating case, but let me go back to something you just said and that term you use, material support. And I need help understanding that, as I'm sure a lot of people do. So what do we mean? I mean, Harvey Silverglate is talking about speech. You're talking about something called speech as providing material support.
I think you even heard, my friend Jared Brockman even referred to it, saying this is different. In this type of a conflict, what we're dealing with, and I would even argue the incitement is fairly imminent by the translation. What you're seeing is someone that's translating for the purposes of overthrowing the, disrupting the Middle East power structure at the minimum, and disrupting the United States as it stands in the West, Western thinking and political thought as it exists. So these are insightful words. These aren't words like screw the draft, which is what, I won't use the word specifically, that was used in Brandenburg, but those types of items or protests. This is specific action, a call to action that's imminent in terms of the warfare we're fighting. We're not dealing with planes or tanks lining up along the border of Canada or in Germany or in Poland. But we're actually dealing with, it just takes one person, folks, one member of Al-Qaeda, to act as if they're a warrior now in this day and age and take out the tea in Boston
now
and disrupt the lives of Bostonians for years to come.
Sure, and we get that. And I want to get back to Harvey Silverglate, but Glenn Solmazzi, let me just throw one more thought at you that Harvey brought up, and that is, you know, is what's happening here, is the government essentially trying to weaken that First Amendment in order to combat terrorism?
No, I think again, remember, this is the federal government. It's the Justice Department, the Obama Justice Department. Mm-hmm. I would doubt we have to stop and pull ourselves back from it and not think that the prosecution team is trying to diminish the First Amendment or use it as a means to assist federal prosecutors in the future. I think literally it's trying to protect the country. They found this case. There's a series of charges against this individual. And the great thing I think we should hold on to would never be allowed by an Al-Qaeda fighter or Osama bin Laden or any other members of Al-Qaeda is that we're having a trial. If this is not true, if this didn't take place, that's why we have this wonderful system of justice in America where this case is being tried. We're going to find out whether he did do it, whether he did commit conspiracy to provide material support to terrorists, whether he did plan to travel over to Yemen, maybe not to go to those terrorist camps, but to maybe interact with people who are involved in the activity. You have to remember, 50% or more of the captured Al-Qaeda fighters are Yemeni. So to say that they were just going over just for purely academic reasons is interesting and potentially true, and that's what a court of law is there to find out and discover for us before neutral and detached judges and juries that will make this determination for us rather than us having to just, the government's not saying, oh, he didn't do this, we're going to take away your First Amendment rights. Yeah. We're trying this in a court of law.
Can I give an example of clear and present danger? Because
sure. Then I have another question for you, but go ahead.
Nothing that we say is going to be comprehensible without an example. Clear and present danger. Here's a situation. You have somebody rabble-rousing in the Boston Common giving a speech, and here is where there's a clear and present danger of violence. The speaker says, there's a Christian, or there's a Jew, or there's a black, and the next block. This country would be better off without them. Let's get them, okay? That is incitement to immediate violence. That's what the courts mean by clear and present danger. But if the speaker says, this country would be better off without such and such group, we really should drive them out, that is not a clear and present danger example. Now, that may sound like a minor distinction, but it's not. It's the difference between a free society and a society which allows people to spout off. And Mahana, if you look closely at what's charged in this case, he spouted off. And that's all that he's guilty of. And that's protected activity.
I don't know. With all due respect, I can't say spouting off is translating a text that calls for the steps which to engage in warfare against the United States and Western interests. Is
well,
just spouting off.
Of course it is, because he has not actually sat down and planned with people to do this, which would be a conspiracy to commit violence. He has translated scripts, and that's protected activity. If I translated Mein Kampf from the German, I wouldn't be guilty of advocating the annihilation of Jews and gypsies.
I hope not. That's right. But I think the conspiracy to provide material support, so not the conspiracy to engage in terrorism, the charge is conspiracy to provide material support. So he clearly is engaged in some sort of activity and is being tried on those, potential charges. You have an outside witness who is confirming he's gone to Yemen. You have
scripts. Glenn, I can actually add a little background to this. Prosecutors allege that a second man, right, Ahmad Abu Samra of Mansfield, also of Massachusetts, tried to join a terrorist training camp overseas. We talked about that. They were rejected. They planned to shoot shoppers at a suburban mall, according to this witness, but scrapped that plan because they couldn't get automatic weapons. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, no, and that's conspiracy to provide. Again, we're not even charging, as far as I know, with conspiracy to engage in terrorist acts. It's conspiracy to provide material support.
Right, there's a reason.
And again, that is important for us and the listeners to think about. What you have when you say, well, he grew up as a fine young person and grew up in the States. I'm sure he did, and I'm certain, and I'm hopeful that he's acquitted, that he's innocent of these charges. But we're trying to find that out. But John Walker Lind was the same way, and he shot at U.S. soldiers. Alaki was a fine U.S. citizen. The Times Square bomber was in Nigeria. The Christmas Day bomber was a fine person until radicalized. So I think, you know, the government has a role, the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office and the military commissions or whatever systems being employed, to protect the citizenry of the United States. And what they're doing by doing this is merely charging. We're innocent until proven guilty. There's a court trial going on. We'll determine it. But we have to give it its fair due here that certainly the government has to be on guard against this sort of activity now in the 21st century warfare we're engaged in. It's different.
I actually want to bring that up, but let me just put the number out and encourage our listeners to get in on this conversation. Listeners, we're talking about the case, the government's prosecution of Tariq Mahana. What do you make of this case? Given what we know that groups like Al-Qaeda are capable of, is the government justified in prosecuting cases like this? You can give us a call and join the conversation with Harvey Silverglate and Glenn Sulmasy. 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Harvey Silverglate, Glenn Sulmasy sort of raised a point that I wanted to raise with both of you, and that is history is changing. I mean, I understand your point about clear and present danger, but given the way terrorist networks work, given the way they recruit, given the power of the internet, I guess my question is, should I be surprised if this standard is changing, if you see what I mean?
Well, the standards, civil liberty standards, have historically changed in this country during times of war. And then they have gone back when peace has been achieved, when the war is over, they've gone back to being a more free society. The problem is that this seems to be a never-ending war. It's been going on since 2001, and we don't see the end of it. And the real question is, are we now in the process of making permanent changes in the liberties that have been enjoyed by Americans for generations? And I fear that that's what's being attempted by the Department of Justice in trials like Tariq Mahana. I noticed that Glenn pointed out that there's no charge of conspiracy to engage in terrorism. Why isn't there such a charge? Because that's not what he was doing. Nothing that he did rises to that level. Instead, the charge is something vague and mushy like conspiracy to render material support. I could sit here for 6 hours and explain why that is absolutely a meaningless phrase legally. This jury is going to be told to do what it wants.
Well, we don't have 6 hours, but Glenn Sulmasy, let me read what Saya Samura writes on RadioBoston.org. This is a terrifying case and just illustrates the unchecked power of the federal government. News organizations make Al-Qaeda translations available to the public. They broadcast Osama bin Laden videos. Why isn't the media prosecuted under the same ridiculous, in quotes, laws?
Well, I think that's a great question by your listener, but I think what we want to look at, there's more to this case than that. We can look at just traveling. This is one component of a case that's being put together carefully by a prosecution team over 2 years and perhaps even over a six-year period, that we're looking at the travel overseas. We have actual witnesses that are involved with providing very specific testimony about activities of the individual. We have more to the case than just simply that, and I do think that defense counsel should be applauded for trying to raise these issues as red herrings and make this case purely about the First Amendment, but I think that's not really what the issue is at stake here. It's much more than that, and this is one component which is fascinating, and it does, again, as we said, show that struggle and tension between civil liberties, promotion of human rights and the rule of law, and national security. But I think we have to recognize, as you alluded to earlier, sir, that warfare is changing. When Brandenburg was decided, there was no internet, there were no cell phones. That's why the Patriot Act was enacted, in order to keep up with the cell phone use, which is different than our old telephones. Most of our students, my students anymore, don't even know that there was such a thing as a payphone, or that I had a typewriter. I mean, this sort of thing is, we have to keep up. And I'm certain that Harvey would agree that our Constitution is a living, breathing document that adapts and changes over time. And we seem to have to be able to, unfortunately, struggle with this now.
Well, it's living and breathing, but if this case is won by the government, it'll be on life support, breathing very, very slowly.
One thing I'll agree with Harvey about, if I could, I think he's right that this is a long war, this 10-year activity.
Sure.
Has inserted all sorts of problems for us, whether we use military commissions, which one will start next week, or whether we use civilian courts. We're still struggling with those issues, and I think Harvey and I would agree that's something that we have to come to grips with.
Well, I think that's one of the things this case is trying to come to grips with, and as you suggested, Glenn, this is why we're talking about it. And there are a bunch of listeners that would like to get on this conversation. Let's go to Matthew, who's calling from Brookline. Hi, Matthew.
Hello.
You're on the air. What's on your mind?
My statement is to Harvey, I strongly agree with freedom of speech. However, I would not want someone to say to me in a confrontation, I am angry, I'm going to kill you and your children. I believe that's illegal. Similarly, if I were to say, I don't like the way the American Civil Liberties Union is acting, I'm going to blow up their building. I believe that would be illegal, even if it's not clear and present, whether it's today, tomorrow, or a week from now.
Harvey Silverglaze.
That all depends on the context. A threat to you directly, I am going to kill you and your children. If there's reason to believe that it's not a joke and it's serious, then it's a threat. That is that has been the law since before the United States even got started. So that's really a very easy one. Somebody saying they're going to blow up some government building, well, if there's actually a plan to do that, that's a conspiracy to commit violence. But that's not what the Mahana case is about. You have to look, the devil is in the details. The prior caller sent an email,
sure,
asking the question, why isn't the media prosecuted for showing a bin Laden video? And
yeah,
that's a very interesting question. And I have no doubt that the Department of Justice wishes it could do that. It isn't quite ready. The First Amendment hasn't been adequately shredded. They're hoping to do that, I think, in the prosecution of WikiLeaks. And I will be willing to bet I'll come back here in 2 years. You play me back this statement and I will have been correct in my prognostication. They are going after Mahana because they don't have the guts yet to go after WikiLeaks, nor the New York Times, but come back in 2 years.
Hmm. Well, Glenn Solmezzi, I heard you're reacting there at the end of the phone line. What's your take on what Harvey just said?
I think it's wonderful to hear it. I think he's a wonderful advocate for his cause and for civil liberties, which is critical. And I think even Matthew from Brookline started off with saying, of course, we're all for civil liberties. I think that I would suggest that the federal government is not looking to use the Boston case, the Mahana case, as a ruse for WikiLeaks. I don't think that they're ever going to go after the New York Times. I think that we always have to be on check against an overreaching federal government. We'd all agree with that. Our Constitution is founded on that. Our country was founded on that. But I don't see that in this case. I see this as a case as being about an individual. As we noted, we have a clear history and a track record of young men who are otherwise fine becoming radicalized and engaging in activities against the United States interests as part of the greater war in Al-Qaeda. So we have that taking place, and while that's taking place, we have to be ever super conscious of the activities that this could render for the future, and we have to be able to use that for our activities as best as possible.
Let's take another call from Ethan, who's calling from Jamaica Plain. Hi, Ethan.
How you doing today?
Very well. What's on your mind?
I think there's some similar things that have been said by both, but I think it's important to understand material support. And that's not a new concept for what we've seen overseas. And material support can be a lot of things, but it all contributes to the total outcome of what is eventually a terrorist act. And I think you have to look at this individual's previous acts and look at the totality of all that to say that this is not just a question of someone expressing themselves, but actually looking to actually carry out something or at least facilitate other people to carry out something.
Hmm. So is that, Harvey Silverglade, what Ethan says, I mean, is that essentially on the docket? Is that the thing that's being considered? Because you sort of been maintaining that it's just about the translation. But of course, it is a more complex case that has been going on for a few years that involves other allegations of association, of trips that he took, of talking about, blowing up a mall and trying to get weapons, and even though he didn't do it.
I think Glenn answered the question when he pointed out the government has not charged a conspiracy to engage in terrorist attacks. Mm-hmm. The reason they didn't charge it is because the evidence is not there. This guy was a talker and not a doer. And frankly, the only reason that they ended up prosecuting him, in addition to wanting to slowly get the law to change, is because he would not become an informant. Had he become an informant, he would be taken out and dined and wined and dined in good restaurants rather than prosecuted.
Let me ask, get you both to chime in on this. And I was doing a little reading before we went on the air. And at the heart of this case, my understanding is a recent Supreme Court opinion that you can belong to a terrorist organization, you can advocate for the goals of a terrorist organization, but you can't work for them or be in coordination with them. Does this ring a bell with you, Glenn Silmazy? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, this is what we're talking about. This is the courts and the Supremes and others struggling with just what Harvey's alluding to and trying to ensure we don't overstep the bounds of free speech and affiliation and association, but actually working for. And in this case, it's the trial is really about that very issue, about whether they're working for or not. And I'm certain the prosecution team, having not had the opportunity to listen to testimony today, we'll be bringing that up throughout the trial, that there is an indicia, certainly probably beyond a reasonable doubt, that he was working for, but that's up to them to prove that.
Mm-hmm. You were speaking about the Humanitarian Law Project case that the Supreme Court decided.
You've got me over barrel. I'm not really sure.
It is.
Yeah, I think it's Humanitarian. That case, I challenge anybody listening to this broadcast to read that opinion and tell me what it means. It shows that the Supreme Court, its own thinking is currently in a state of flux, and there's great confusion as to where to draw the line between protected activity and providing so-called material support. And the one of the goals of the department in prosecutions like they're going now here in Boston is in order to try to develop the law interpreting statutes like this and interpreting the First Amendment in a manner that's more favorable to the government and less favorable to liberty. And that's the big struggle that we're in, and nobody can predict how that's going to turn out.
Hmm. Well, we got time for one more call. Let's go to Tom, who's calling from Plymouth. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Thanks for my call. Hey, I wanted to ask whether or not a translation who owns the copyright on a translation, and is that a factor in whether or not it's actually material support? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, Tom. Harvey, can you take that question?
I doubt that that Mahan or anybody else has copyrighted the translation. People translate things all the time, including many vile things. That, until now, has been a scholarly activity that's been protected by the First Amendment. This is one of the arenas where the government's trying to change the law. You translate these kind of tracts. You show a bin Laden, like Glenn raised it, you show a bin Laden video, and suddenly, rather than engage in the kind of protected activity Americans have been doing forever, suddenly you become helping the enemy. And that's the change, the huge cultural and legal shift that they're trying to effect.
Glenn Silmazy, we have about 10 or 15 seconds left. I want to give you the last word. Respond to what Harvey said or to Tom, who just called about that copyright question.
No, I think I would defer to the copyright experts. I think the big issue for us to recognize is this is a Mahana is a case for us to watch, to observe and recognize. This shows and highlights the struggles we're having, that we've updated ourselves strategically, tactically, but legally we're still struggling with how best to detain, adjudicate, interrogate terrorists once captured.
Captain Glenn Silmazy, he's a law professor at the U.S. Coast Guard Academy in Connecticut. Glenn Silmazy, thanks so much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much. We send our best to you all from UIA here down in UIA in Miami Beach.
Well, same to you. Harvey Silverglate, criminal defense attorney here in Boston, author of Three Felonies a Day, How the Feds Target the Innocent. Harvey, always a pleasure to have you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
After the break, one of our own bosses at WBUR gets a lesson in the importance of warming up and cooling down. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.